845.
Good morning, Dr. Chitwood.
Good morning.
We are here in the Health Sciences Library at East Carolina University. It's August 9th, 2001, and I would like your permission to record the continuation of the interview that we began in July.
You have my permission.
Thank you. I was hoping that we could begin by just letting you describe the kind of surgery you're involved in right now.
We've begun to do minimally invasive surgery. We became interested in this about 1995, and the notion is to do do operations through small incisions so there's less musculoskeletal trauma to the patient. We developed the operation that we have perfected, the videoscopic operation, where we use cameras, very much like laparoscopic surgery. My gallbladder was taken out last Friday in about 20 minutes, and so we've tried to develop operations that can be done without as much trauma, using cameras only, the secondary vision rather than primary ocular vision, and to be able to repair valves and replace valves. And then we move from there to doing operations through small incisions using robots, which are really facilitating, enabling instruments that allowed us to reach into tiny spaces with tiny hands and place sutures accurately, and to have visualization that was better than the human eye with 10 times magnification, three-dimensionality, and so that you're truly ensconced in the operative site, the operative topography.
How did you first become aware? I'm assuming that in your training you perform surgery the traditional way, with open chest surgery, and a lot of that's still being done.
Every day.
How did you become aware of the minimally invasive and interested in that?
Well, I think we developed it. I mean, we didn't become aware. We were the progenitors of it, in that we had seen our other colleagues do things minimally invasively, but no one was willing to attempt to do heart surgery around large vessels and complex operations. There was more chance to get in trouble. Not many people were willing to do this through tiny incisions. In fact, we were all trained to use large incisions for safety and access. And so the notion came that I've thought about it for many years, about being able to do heart surgery endoscopically. This is not really rocket science. We've been able to evaluate the gallbladder and do some operations, but most abdominal operations are extirpative or destructive, ligating or cauterizing an ovarian, a fallopian tube, removing a gallbladder, and some fairly gross reconstructions such as a Nissen fund application. But we were now asking ourselves, could we do very fine detailed anastomoses with 1 and 2 millimeter coronary arteries or complex valve repairs? And I felt that we would be able to do this, or at least we'd be able to move in this direction, and maybe the technology would evolve and co-apt with where we wanted to go. So we first started doing minimally invasive operations with long instruments and long cameras, two-dimensional cameras, and then we finally realized that you had to have your hands placed at the operative site. Well, that's impossible to do if you're going through a small incision and the heart is a foot away. So therefore, you have to take the hands inside the heart, these micro hands, and you have to be able to use a micro-manipulative device called a robot. Robot's really not operating autonomously. It's operating as a facilitating instrument for the surgeon, who does all the manipulations, but they're translated in 1-to-1 fashion or 3-to-1 or whatever ratio you would like into this tiny space to recreate the exact movements and maybe even better movements than man can make, because there are electronic filters in there that take out tremor. So you become ambidextrous, being able to operate with both hands, your non-dominant hand as well as your dominant hand, and being able to see much better, where the papillary muscles, instead of being 2 centimeters, they're now giant sequoia trees. And so that you can really, you're really a participant in the operation. You're really right there with accuracy.
And this is on a screen.
This is operating through a screen or a console, where you're looking at a screen, looking down into a screen. sitting as my elbows are now touching this table and looking into this screen and being totally immersed in the operative site.
And what sorts of tools do you have in front of you? What sorts of, they're not tools, controls do you have when you're...
Well, you're using instruments that are very similar to our instruments. If you touch them and you close your eyes, they feel the same. When you look at them, they're different because there are no end pieces. They go into electronic sensors. But with the hand piece, very much like their little Velcroed loops that we use, and basically we move them in the same fashion as if we were sewing here on this table. As if we were taking stitches on this table with our hands and our, at the end of the pencil, the instrument is moving. We now look into the screen, and so we totally become fooled by the device. As we see, we move our hands, the instrument moves in the screen. You forget that you're looking through a device. You think of it as looking with your eyes. And so you take an instrument that is formerly a 6-inch instrument through a wide open chest procedure to a 12-inch instrument down through a tiny hole. Now you take that 6-inch instrument down inside the chest as if the chest wall was invisible and you could just put your hands right inside the heart.
Is the instrument still 6 inches long?
We have a long arm, but you have these tips that have the same accuracy and facility of a 6-inch instrument. Remember, the shorter you grip up on an instrument toward the tip, the more it becomes an extension of your hand. So there's less tremor. So we normally operate with 6-inch instruments, and we have great facility because the human hand has great accuracy. But if we extend the length of that instrument, we amplify the tremor, and it becomes less accurate. So to do the same things with long instruments, you have to be able to have some sort of filtration system. And that's what the robot provides.
I see. How did robots come to be thought of in connection with surgery? Whose idea was that? When did that happen?
Well, I think in the mid to late 90s, surgeons first considered that you could move cameras with robots, with voice activation. That you could use the long instruments and you can move the camera, you know, right, left, in, out, and you wouldn't have to have an assistant to hold the camera. And that was the first very simple robotic device, simple commands, simple action. It was basically a camera holder that was automated and voice activated. That went from the Army and the military in the mid-60s trying to develop these micro-manipulators so that we could possibly operate on soldiers who were injured in the field from a distance. And that really didn't work out that well. And so the work started at the Stanford Research Institute to try to develop this for surgical technology. And I think the group with Intuitive, the Intuitive Surgical Company, who bought the patents, finally realized that this, you don't need to be able to operate over great distances. What you need to be able to do is operate over across the chest wall. But that was the distance you really needed to, or the abdomen, that you needed to subtend a, you know, 18-inch span, you know, with excellence.
Just pardon my naivete, but why did they want to operate at a distance for, in the case of soldiers?
Well, the notion is you can't provide surgeons to every part of the field, and therefore one surgeon could operate on many injured soldiers in different places. Also, they're out of harm's way. You have more soldiers than you do have surgeons, so your surgeon becomes a valued resource. You can't put them in the field hospital, you put them in the general hospital.
I see. Well, that helps a lot. You mentioned sutures in the minimally invasive procedures, and I know in our last interview you mentioned the new biological glue. You still using both, or you're still using the sutures, although the...
Mostly sutures. We're trying to develop clips and different types of suturing devices, such as ultrasonic welding, rather than tying sutures with the little hands, the micro hands, that we can actually weld these polypropylene sutures together with one buzz, or using specialized clips that will, once deployed, will clip valves in place or do coronaries. Glues may be used as an adjunctive device for areas of bleeding or for adjunctive attachment with clips for sealing small gaps and holes.
Incredibly intricate.
It's intricate, but
fascinating,
it's
fascinating area.
Carpenters do it every day on a different scale.
Yeah. You mentioned some of the other technologies that have developed over the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. You mentioned parenteral nutrition. That's been a great aid to surgery, the success of surgical procedures. And you also mentioned advances in tissue preservation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the different types of tissue preservation. It subtends a large subject. From transplantation to myocardial preservation of the heart during a heart operation. Let's talk about that.
Sure.
That's one of the great advances in cardiac surgery, the ability to operate on the heart in a quiescent, still manner that is metabolizing at a very low level. It has subliminal metabolism, non-beating heart. And the notion is the high-energy phosphate stores are finite, and if they can't be replenished with blood while you're operating on the heart, then they begin to decrease, and they will decrease to a point that the heart becomes irreparably injured. So therefore, if you're doing a two-hour operation, you want to be able to stop the heart with minimal metabolic damage and to be able to repair the heart. And we've developed technology, techniques, biochemistries that can stop the heart in the diastolic phase, cool the heart, preserve the high energy phosphate store, so we can operate on a transplant, a heart carried around in a cooler in the airplane for 6 hours and then insert it, or stop the heart and work on a valve for 4 hours.
You actually stop the heart in the middle of the beat, basically.
You stop it in its beat, in its relaxation phase, and make it a flaccid, quiescent, docile, non-combative heart that lies quietly there while you repair it.
That's wonderful. And what about the anesthesia? You mentioned that as well.
Well, anesthetics have improved. Of course, the development of anesthesia by a number of people in the mid-1800s, by Crawford in the South and the group at the Mass General in the North, and Simpson with chloroform in Scotland. That was a real breakthrough in allowing surgery to come to advance. And anesthesia advanced greatly in those early years, but then sort of stopped. But recently we've been able to develop anesthetics that have less neurologic residua, that have less myocardial or cardiac depression, that maintain organs better. And so that you're essentially like going to sleep. You wake up feeling okay. I mean, I woke up last week at an hour after surgery and basically had lunch, a full lunch, a sandwich, at 12 o'clock. And was able to have a regular dinner and to operate the next couple of days. So the anesthetics have changed as well.
Have the techniques of administration changed dramatically, or is it?
Changed from the the ether type of mask that was given in the Morton type from the Mass General, the ether dome where you give drop ether. I used to administer drop ether and help my dad with taking out tonsils with an ether mask. I still have his ether mask. We have a gauze over this mask and you drop ether. Ether was very safe for the patient in that they would achieve certain anesthetic levels that were very easy to define.
By monitoring the pulse and the respiration?
It was much safer than some of the other anesthetics, but patients were violently sick. They had a hangover after the surgery. It was very volatile. It couldn't be used with any electrical devices. It could explode. And so it had some setbacks. Then they started delivering anesthetics after mask ether through endotracheal tubes, where the patient was intubated, and then they started delivering anesthetics as a narcotic intravenously. And that's generally how we deliver it today, but the anesthetics are much better than the past, than pentothal when I was a boy, and ether.
And say you've got an intravenous anesthetic going on. I suppose it's controlled sort of by, it's monitored carefully the amount that goes
Correct.
In. You can back off and
Well, you know, it's interesting because the whole area of anesthesia was really a subsection of surgery in the past years ago. It's become a specialty now. In fact, Harvey Cushing at Johns Hopkins, he was a young staff member there, was the first to use an anesthetic record, where basically you were monitoring blood pressure and urinary output and respiratory rate while the patient was asleep, and to follow trended data. Before that, none of that happened. As I said, it was often given by the surgeon or his nurse, and then it became the anesthesia schools developed. But they were generally under the aegis of a department of surgery, such as at Johns Hopkins. In fact, when I first came to Duke, the anesthesia section was under the Department of Surgery. And, of course, that's evolved to there are many types of anesthesiologists, cardiac, obstetrical, high-risk OBGYN anesthesiologists. And so it's really evolved. And they have many new technologies, such as transesophageal echocardiography, so that they can look at the heart while it's contracting. And maybe a patient who's had a heart attack is getting an abdominal procedure, so they can follow the contractility of the heart much closer. So it is a higher tech business. They can follow the level of anesthesia by brain waves so that they can monitor how deep you are. You don't need to give a little extra because that just gives you more time to wake up and more hangover, so to speak. And so they can monitor how deeply you are in the anesthetic. So it's a whole different thing. If you're throwing a little emboli up an artery, they can monitor that, making surgery much safer. The anesthetic used to be the risk, part of the risk before. Now it's generally not as much of a risk.
Well, that's good to know. You also mentioned catheterization procedures that have developed.
Well, cardiac catheterization procedures have developed very, very rapidly since 1980, interventional procedures. But let me take you back to Werner Forsman, who did the first catheterization. He was a urologist in Germany. I forget the day. I think it was 28 or 29. Passed a ureteric catheter up his arm and walked up two or three stairs and put dye in the catheter and did the first cardiac catheterization. Of course.
Wait a minute, on himself?
On himself. And of course, he was not applauded. He was scolded in that hospital for doing this. And the chief of surgery said he really didn't deserve the esteem of his colleagues. So that was dormant for many years, and in fact, in the late 40s, Cornand and Dickinson Richards and others started doing catheterizations and measuring pressure in the heart, more of an experimental work rather than diagnostic work. And in 1953, Forsman, Richards, and Cornand, Andre Cornand, were given awarded the Nobel Prize. He was one of the seven Nobel laureates who was a surgeon. And not Cornand, but Forsman was. And so the first real diagnostic catheterizations that were beginning to develop were Dr. Bing at Hopkins, and then at the Cleveland Clinic was Mason Soans was the first individual to accidentally stick a catheter in the coronary artery and put dye, thinking the patient would die. It was done accidentally, and the patient did fine. He got a beautiful angiogram of the coronary. So then he started doing it routinely, and then angiography of coronary arteries developed in 1958 at the Cleveland Clinic. Subsequently, most of the work was done not as a therapeutic thing, but as a diagnostic intervention. Children were catheterized for congenital heart disease. I remember when Helen Tausig was doing most of the work at Hopkins in the 40s, she was doing it with a stethoscope in her eyes and her hands, no catheterization, and later with Dr. Bing. But to make a long story short, real interventional cardiology developed when Andreas Grunzig at the Swiss Polyclinic did the first angioplasty, which was a balloon angioplasty, in the coronary artery in, I think it was 1976, and that was based on the work of Dotter, D-O-T-T-E-R, who was a vascular radiologist on the West Coast, who had done peripheral dilatations of arteries. And then Grunzig came to the United States, to Emory, and the story of angioplasty developed. In 1980 was a technique that was beginning to be used at some of the most august centers. By 1984, when I came here, was beginning to proliferate. And then atherectomy catheters developed, ways to administer drugs through catheters. And so the whole area of interventional cardiology with stents developing began to develop.
Can you talk a little bit about the stents? Help us visualize how that works, that repair for stents.
One thing I want to say is a lot of this developed in concert with surgeons and vascular radiologists, cardiologists working very closely together in the same laboratories and being colleagues. Then much of this has developed into different directions, where sometimes the cardiologists have political issues with the surgeons, and the surgeons have the same, because they're trying to really use their therapy on the patients. This will ultimately come back together again now that we're developing cardiovascular diseases centers, because we're placing stents, we're placing in vascular surgery and vascular radiology and cardiology and some cardiac surgery using stents. Now, a stent is like a Chinese finger trap. It can be collapsed or it can be expanded. But when you expand the stent, it stays open. And therefore, with a balloon dilating an artery and smushing the plaque against the wall, and now you open the stent so that it serves as a bridge. It serves as a cage to keep that artery open. We still have 30-40% recurrence of stenosis or narrowing in these stents, so now we're developing new drugs like mithromycin that will inhibit cell growth in the region of that stent and therefore decrease scarring and restenosis. So the combination of interventional cardiology, cardiac surgery, they're all coming back together again. It's a natural history that was bound to happen.
That's wonderful. Well, with all these advances and the new technologies, do you imagine that the kind of vascular surgery that you're involved with now might ever, in our wildest imaginations, be considered part of primary care medicine?
Well, I have very strong feelings coming from primary care. I think that primary care is primary care. And I think that what's happened in the United States is a cycle that happened a long time ago, where you had a plethora of primary care doctors. You didn't have enough specialists. We cranked up schools to turn out specialists. We had too many specialists, and we went back to primary care as the Holy Grail. I think primary care is what it is. It's basically seeing the patient first and seeing them chronically and taking care of their needs on a chronic basis in maintenance. I think it's irresponsible for someone who's in primary care to do a procedure infrequently. It's irresponsible when you can send it to someone who does it as every day, 10 a day, 1,000 a day. The notion is, they say, well, you know, people have to travel. Well, you know, many people will travel 80 miles to buy a suit or a car and have their car serviced. And, you know, that's ridiculous. Or to fly out in the airplane or to go to the beach. So to have your heart worked on to say, well, I can't travel 80 miles or 50 miles is basically a capitulation. So I think the primary care physician needs to be able to be a superb diagnostician, to understand the evolution of a disease process in a specific patient, to see when they've evolved to the point that they do need the specialist. The idea of the primary care doctor treating all the urologic problems, doing cystoscopy, and it would be like me being able to put a chest tube in without being able to take care of the complications of chest tube insertion. I really think that we have enough specialists and physicians that shouldn't do a procedure unless you have some notion and ability and facility and resources to take care of that complication. Mm-hmm. It's different than when my dad was a primary care doctor. When someone had a subdural hematoma and needed a burr hole, and they would die without a burr hole, a trephine, which is basically a hole in the head, they would do that. But now there's a neurosurgeon there, it wouldn't be what you want to do. He delivered all the babies, even the high-risk babies. It would be a responsible day if you were out in the quote boondocks and you have someone who's hypertensive, preeclamptic, and difficult to control, for the family practice doctor to keep trying to take care of that patient, and when they could send the patient 25 miles to a high-risk gynecologic specialist. It's a different era. Doesn't mean that the primary care doctor's not doing good. The other thing is, if you get tied up taking up care of too many high-risk patients as a primary care doctor, then basically you can't do what you came to do. You can't take care of all the other people you have. So I see the primary care doctor in a whole different venue of being a very astute doctor, being able to tell when someone progresses from one stage of disease to the next, being an expert diagnostician, being able to take care of a whole gamut of problems, realizing their limitations.
Sounds very logical and reasonable. Is there any chance, in your opinion, that the need for the kind of vascular surgery that you're doing will decrease in the ideal world where individuals take more responsibility for their own health?
Well, most people don't take that much responsibility. They take responsibility when they want to. Human nature is probably the most interesting thing in all of medicine because basically even people with complex disease, and you can tell them how to solve the disease, they won't take care of it. I think that vascular disease will be intervened upon with catheters and surgical procedures for the next 20 years, 25 years. And then I think we'll have a whole breakthrough in new drugs and genetic therapy for atherosclerosis and finding the real causes of it. Now, we may be able to give someone the solution to take care of their atherosclerosis by saying, you're going to develop atherosclerosis and you need to take this pill, but you also need to take away these risk factors in your life and never smoke and never do this and never become a diabetic, never do this. And then people will choose to either honor that or not. So they may take the pill and still manifest this disease much later. So there will always be a subform, there will always be enough non-compliant people, or increased in population, or new forms of atherosclerosis that will develop because of diet and other environmental conditions that we'll be treating. Mm-hmm. So we'll be pushing back the tide in the next 50 years, but we'll still have plenty to do in both interventional as well as in biochemical therapeutic treatment of this disease, same way with every disease.
Thank you for that little foreshadowing. That's very instructive. Dr. Cunningham reports here that you told him about a day, you're conceptualizing a day, when surgical services will be teleported to rural areas and expertise can be shared through high-speed telemedicine linkages. Can you help us visualize that?
Again, I think that people who do operations have to have a certain amount of background, a certain amount of training. Mm-hmm. I think that using telemedicine or teleteaching or teledirection, whatever, can facilitate a surgeon who is skilled in the basics but now wants to go to a different level of support for more complex operations that he can handle in his specific facility, his or her facility, or in places that have very low access, very poor access, Antarctica, you know, space shuttles and things of this nature. But in rural areas, you'll be able to, I think in time, have have one surgeon in a place where you used to have two. There's a big shortage of surgeons, tremendous shortage, much bigger shortage of surgeons than there are family practice doctors. And you say, well, that's not true. Well, if you consider that all surgeons are categorized, urologists, all these different, they're all surgeons. If we talk about general surgeons who can go into a rural community and practice, there's a huge shortage. So I think you'll have less people out there to do this kind of work, and they all can't come to the big center for the simple operation. So I think you can have physicians, you can have one thing like monitoring. You can have a central site for monitoring in a different place. You can have people with good communication sending angiograms for opinions, sending chest x-rays for opinions, sending medical history for opinions. I think there'll be much more telecommunication. But the idea that we're taking someone through his first abdominal aortic aneurysm operation by telemedicine is a bit ridiculous and probably won't happen. What is it? It's the future, and it always will be in the future.
It's you've talked about the instruction, telemedicine used in instruction, but I suppose there's also the issue of equipment that has to be centralized if the equipment needed for procedure is so expensive. And
well, I think there'll be certain procedures that will be centralized. You know, it's silly for every heart program to have a robotic device unless they're very economical, or you have it as part, maybe in 30 years, be part of the standard training. Then that may be more reasonable. But right now, you know, at the cost and also the expertise. The worst thing that you can do for a physician is to develop the technology to the point that it makes he or she think that they're a better doctor and give them the confidence way above their capabilities, only to find that they create a complication and open up Pandora's box and they're not prepared to do it. Education requires not only to be able to do the procedure, but take care of the complications, understand the pathophysiology of disease. When I see a complication in my area, I handle it with comfort. Maybe I'm not happy about it, but I handle it with comfort and knowing exactly what to do.
And that sort of confidence comes from years of training.
It comes from training. It's like flying. It's like a combat pilot. You know, bleeding, you know, if bleeding makes you nervous, then you're either not there yet or you shouldn't be there. I had a young fellow the other day, had a hole in the aorta. Well, it's audible bleeding, you know. And had his finger on the hole, and I said, "What are you going to do next, bud?" And I was looking over the screen. So I'm going to do this, do that. And I said, "Well, why don't you just wait, let me scrub you in." Because I knew the guy didn't know what to do. And he would have fired a bunch of stitches in there, lost 5 units of blood, and probably gotten it under control. I went in and put my finger over the hole. Could feel the hole. If you can feel a hole, it's a big one. And basically said, "You don't have enough exposure." Opened the retractor a little bit more, put a clamp on the aorta, pulled it down so I could see it, got good exposure. Then put a suture around the tip of my finger, and then put another suture around the tip around that as a purse string. Had the guy across the table pull the purse string down as I let my finger down, and I tied the knot on the other side, and we didn't lose 20 cc's. But he had, you know, what I'm saying is that's something that takes it, you know, was I nervous? No, the only time I was nervous is when I was sitting there watching this guy. So you know, what I'm saying, that comes with experience, that comes with, you know, someone training me to how exactly how to handle that. And that's what I'm saying. You know, they say, "Well, opening the chest and looking at the aorta is no big deal." Well, you know, a lot of young residents, they just want to open the chest and look at the thing, but don't know what to do with it.
What happens? Well, we're mighty fortunate to have you here to show them what to do with it. It's wonderful. You mentioned, back to your background in medicine a little bit. I think this might be a good time to turn the tape.
Okay. Over.